and welcome to episode 66 of the Payers and Players podcast. My name's Robert. I'm here with Scott and Mr. Brian Wilson. Brian, Scott, how are y'all today?
Doing good.
So today is episode two of our interviews with Brian. We've done one already. This is a episode two of like a multi-part series that we're going to do with Brian. So Scott, why don't you lead in for today's episode?
Yeah. So in our first episode with Brian, we went into Brian's background and we talked a little bit about his observations at Kalamazoo and the U.S. Open. Today we want to talk about what the state of U.S. tennis and what academies are doing well and what they're not doing well. And we can start by sort of talking about what Brian's doing at his academy in Las Vegas at the Darling Tennis Center. So maybe Brian, you can give us an overview of your sort of high performance tennis training at Darling, and then we can take it from there.
Awesome. Well, hey, thanks guys for having me on. This is a fantastic, great to chat tennis with you. A little overview about Darling. So Darling is a fully public facility. We have 23 courts and we've got a really great large staff. I think even before we get into the high performance section, I think it's important to understand what that means. A lot of times, you know, parents and players will say, hey, you know, my son is or daughter is a high performance player. For me, that, you know, that word is very general. And a lot of the time, you know, all of the kids come and say, hey, I'm a high performance player. But I'm only coming 2 days a week. And that's not a high performance player, right? We want players that are committed, that are playing, you know, 4 or 5 days a week, and also are competing regularly. And that's one thing that, you know, with COVID has been lacking the competition, you know, framework. So I want to make sure any player that's coming to the program is not only committed to practice, but is committed to playing tournaments. And that's one where we see a lot of players, especially in the last, you know, 10 years, I've seen it more, you know, parents trying to protect the players from competition and, you know, saying they're not ready or they need to take a break. You know, and there's sometimes they need to take a break, but, you know, I really want those players getting out there and competing, getting quality matches, you know, making sure they're understanding how to problem solve on their own. So, you know, number one, making sure the player is committed, you know, not only to training, but tournaments. At Darling, we do a fantastic job with the young players. And that's, you know, I think we touched on it a little bit in the last episode, you know, but how passionate I am and our staff is about training young players properly. Now, when I say training young players properly, it's creating the right mindset. The mindset is so important. The mindset of a tennis player to be resilient, to understand there are going to be, you know, lots and lots of setbacks, lots of losses, but to continue to move forward and have a plan. You know, the main thing I try to get across to young players and parents is we're trying to create a player with lots of different skills. And a lot of times when we try to do that, the parents get a little bit nervous because the players fail a lot in the beginning. You know, teaching a, you know, 5, 6, 7-year-old how to hit a backhand volley, you know, is tough. You know, they're not fully developed. You know, they struggle a lot. And the parents and sometimes the players, you know, they get frustrated. So just, you know, understanding the process, but we love to play games with the kid, to teach them the skills of how to be a complete player, you know, how to use a slice, how to serve and volley, how to play doubles. That's a huge thing that we teach, you know, our 10 and under players. It was fun. Yesterday we had junior team tennis. My son was playing and, you know, they're winning pretty easily. And I said, hey, I said, throw in a serve and volley. And he goes, really? And I said, yeah, we do it all the time in practice. And he just doesn't do it much in matches, right? And he's 8 years old, you know, playing orange ball. So he does a serve and volley, misses. I say, hey, do it again. Second time, does it really well, executes. And everyone's like, whoa, that was weird. but yeah, just, you know, it's really important for the kids to you know, learn how to get to the net. I'm a little biased because I did that a lot, you know, in my career. But it makes the game more fun, you know. And if a player gets to 13, 14 years old, now they're in our high performance program and they can choose what game style works for them. Right. Not only in,
you know, Brian,
yep. Go ahead.
Brian, one of my questions around that is, so I see a lot of times, especially in academies, is an over emphasis on technique.
and not enough emphasis on playing a variety of players and just finding a way to win. And yeah. You look at a player like Medvedev, who has what most pros probably wouldn't teach in his technique, and yet he's still highly proficient. At what point do you just say, okay, the player's got the technique they're going to have. Now let's just allow them to be a problem solver and find a way to win.
Wow. That's a great question. Yeah. I mean, I would say, you know, there's, you know, some players absolutely have the technique, you know, pretty well ingrained by, you know, 13, 14 years old. You know, and I would say by, you know, yeah, by 14, 15, it's going to be pretty hard to change something they've been doing for, you know, 6 years. So yeah, I would say around that time, you know, when you identify a player's game style, you know, you should be doing that around 12, 13 years old. Then as you work through their game style and what works best to make them successful long-term, there may be some technical things that are outside of a parameter, right? As a coach and director, we always have parameters, right? We want either this grip or this grip. We're not going to teach everyone the same forehand grip. There's a certain parameter, right? But if a player has some technique that's outside that parameter, but still can execute, certain tactical plays, right, then we're going to let them go with it. You know, as we see some players, you know, transition from, you know, 12 years old until 14, you know, I teach, you know, a parameter between Eastern and semi-Western forehand grip. If they go to Western at, you know, 14, 15 years old, most of the time I'm not going to change them back, right, because that's essentially what they've chosen. But yeah, and then you just work with it, right? Obviously Medvedev, he, you know, on his forehand side, he's got an incredibly large loop. You know, as we saw at the US Open, the courts are very fast. I mean, I was there talking with several pros, including Rajiv Ram, you know, one of the doubles, and talking about the speed of the court. Now, how does Medvedev, you know, how does he cancel it out? Well, he plays so far back, right? So he's playing, you know, 10 feet farther back than most pros. So he can hide the fact that he has a larger loop and usually would be late if he played close to the baseline. We saw Fernandez, right? Incredible technique, very compact. She plays super close to the baseline, but is able to do so because of those technical components.
Yeah, and I want to go back maybe also and talk a little bit about, you know, when to introduce competition into the development of a child, you know. So, you know, one of the things you mentioned was playing tournaments, and, you know, so if you're developing a player who's 7, 8 years old, should they be playing the same amount of tournaments as somebody who's 13, 14, who's more further along the development path? Is the competition at an early age as important as it is later, or how would you sort of modulate that?
It's even more important, to be honest. Okay. Now, when we talk about competition, we have to understand the framework, right? There's all different levels of competition. Competition is not just, you know, one thing. It's not just going and playing a USTA tournament that's one and done. It's not just playing a level 5. It's not just playing a level 1. There's all different levels of competition. So when you have young players, you know, even if they're, you know, 4, 5, 6 years old, you have to introduce competition. Whether that's, you know, hey, if you can finish your shot on balance, you know, and count to three, mm-hmm. you know, you get a point, right? That's, you know, that in itself is competition. Maybe they're competing right. against other kids in line. Yeah. The next one would be, okay, the first player to do, you know, 2 touch, you know, they can control the ball and get it over the net 10 times in a row, right? That player gets a point. That player, you know, if they don't get it, they get a strike. That's right. competition.
Yeah.
So developing that mindset, right, in young athletes is very important. So, you know, I run a 10-under program, or say 11-under program 3 times a week. And in every class, every 90-minute class, the players know they're going to have 3 components. They're going to have some type of, you know, agility and running and relays. They're going to have some type of skill that they're going to build, right? They need to improve, whether it's their backhand, their serve, their volley, and then they're going to have competition. And usually it's team-based, right, with those young players, because one of the big things we teach is how to encourage your teammates, right? And you know, a lot of times we'll play doubles as well. But yeah, there's all different levels of competition. It's like I said, it's more important at a young age, because if you don't introduce competition for the first 2 or 3 years of a player that plays, It's going to be harder for them to, you know, understand really what it's all about when they get into a regular tournament.
Yeah. And, you know, part of competition. Go ahead, Scott.
Well, I was just going to say, I like that answer because, you know, what most people think of as competition is tournaments. And so they want to put their kids in tournaments maybe before they've addressed technical issues or they can really know how to play. And now they're just going out there and they're throwing all the things that they're trying to work on in their development out the window because it's easier to get the ball across the net if I use a continental grip and I just push it across and wait for the other person to miss. So by you saying that, you know, you introduce competition in different ways, that also rewards the proper technique, proper development, then you're achieving both ends at that point.
Absolutely. And the proper, you know, emotional response, you know, I mean, I think, you know, a lot of times parents, you know, and mainly parents that haven't played sports, you know, they're expecting a certain thing. They're already creating a certain idea in their mind of what their child needs to do. And that's usually perfection. That's usually winning. But if we introduce competition in smaller scales, right, and you know, but less pressure situations, right, that's going to help the player react and be emotionally sound when they do get into, you know, the tournaments.
Yeah, so you think about competing and skill building, but at what point as they're working along through that skill building process and you kind of notice what their weaknesses and their strengths are, and, you know, you start to work on them, right? So you're working on the weaknesses and you're working on the strengths, but then part of the game is injuries. And so then you have to kind of strike a balance between building skill and not overdoing it to the point of injury. So what are some of the ways that you optimize the training level so that the players can get as good as possible, but at the same time, they don't have those moments where they lose 3 months because of injury?
Well, yeah, I mean, that starts at the beginning. You know, I mean, like you said, technique is very important. The second, you know, thing that's very important is playing multiple sports, is having the kids, you know, or educating the parents that, you know, the child needs to play another sport, you know, whether that's at the same level as tennis, the same commitment, or maybe it's at the lighter level, at a club level, non-club level, that's great. I mean, I played three sports until I was 15. And back then, that was a little bit longer than most. Obviously, today, you know, players are specializing at 10, 11 years old. That's not good. So educating the parents that a second sport is really important, you know, and even if they are implementing other sports into your program. So, you know, we're really lucky at Darling. We've got 23 world-class tennis courts, but we also have 9 soccer fields within about 200 yards of us. So we play a fair amount of soccer. You know, we've introduced, you know, other sports. We've introduced hockey. You know, so it's really important to play those other sports. You know, in these days, you know, a big thing for me, I was pretty on my sleep as an athlete. I remember being at an academy in high school and I had to get 10 hours of sleep every day or I was really cranky. And a lot of the other players, you know, 16, 17 years old, didn't understand that. You know, and I had done some research and coaches had told me, hey, you need to get this much sleep. And, you know, sleep is incredibly important for kids. And we're not seeing that happen. You know, we're seeing them on the cell phone until, you know, late hours of the night. You know, so those are a couple things, you know, good technique from a young age, playing multiple sports, you know, getting sleep and having the right, you know, nutrition can be important to those injuries.
So do you, a lot of kids within academy settings, often to get more training time or homeschool, what's kind of your stance? How does your academy or your area look in the sense of, you know, using homeschool as a way to reduce the amount of in-school time to increase the court time?
Well, that's a good question. And, you know, I've been coaching for a while now and, you know, I've been involved in a couple of programs and, you know, my view now currently is you don't need to homeschool to be great. I'm a big proponent of being really intense, being really dialed in and having goals every single day. This is something, you know, I learned a lot from Andre Agassi, you know, and following his career and reading his book and now getting to pick his brain, you know, at Darling when he's training players. Andre was never a player to play for long periods of time. He just didn't like to do it. But he was ultra, ultra intense during those training sessions. So, you know, I mean, if a player's getting in, you know, 2 to 3 hours of training a day, you know, with 1 or 2 off days here or there, they can still be great. For some players, you know, homeschool may work. You know, obviously the flexibility to travel and play more events. You know, our school system in the U.S. is not the best. So, you know, understanding that, you know, in a 7-hour day, those kids are going to waste a fair amount of time. I'm not against homeschool, you know, in that regard, because, you know, there is a fair amount of time wasted in a regular school day. But sometimes, I should say a lot of the time, when a player goes homeschooled, again, the parents create an idea and have an expectation that their young son or daughter is going to become, you know, world champion in a year. So, you know, understanding, you know, okay, you're homeschooling, right? There still is a process to it, right? There's still going to be plateaus. So, you know, making sure, again, you're setting, you know, proper goals, you're creating a proper tournament schedule. But, you know, I've seen that a lot, you know, and locally we do have a lot of players that homeschool sometimes as early as 9 or 10 years old, which is way too young to homeschool. They're losing out on you know, a lot of the social aspects, and then they put all their eggs in one basket. You know, well, okay, I'm homeschooling for tennis. I'm homeschooling to be great. So it actually backfires, right? So if the coach is not doing a good job, you know, with goal setting and, you know, teaching the parents about the long-term process, homeschooling can backfire.
Yeah. And talk a little bit about, you know, what do you call your maybe academy or your sort of full-time tennis program?
It's just Darling Tennis Center High Performance. Okay. And so
is that for homeschool? Is there hours that are for homeschool kids? And how does that work?
Yeah. So we've got a morning program and an afternoon program. Okay. You know, both sessions are around 2.5 hours. We have, you know, older players, you know, young pros, you know, training in the morning. You know, we've got a couple younger ones, but it's mostly, you know, older players that are on the path to play, you know, high level collegiate tennis and professional tennis. Mm-hmm. And our afternoon program is some of those players, but more younger players that are taking regular schedule.
You know, that's interesting for parents like me with a child who likes to compete, and there really isn't an option close, right? So what do you offer for, because I think there's a lot of folks in the same boat that I'm in and that Scott's in where, you know, if you want to go to an academy, you're going to have to travel. And there are academies out there that will let you put your child on a plane, fly there. Somebody will pick them up. Do y'all have anything like that?
Well, yeah, I mean, we have players coming from all over the country for training here. One of the things that, you know, we have a big advantage here at Darling is that we host so many national tournaments along with UTR events, as you guys know. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think that's one big thing, you know, if, you know, and I lived in an academy in California for 2 years. I was part of Team Adidas and the juniors, which took us to Ball of Terry's, which is now IMG, every summer. So we get multiple weeks of training at Ball of Terry's. You know, living in the dorm. So I've got, you know, and then on tour, I lived in Tampa and I was part of Saddlebrook. So I've got some experience with academies and, you know, some really good experiences. But, you know, one of the things for me, when a player goes and trains at an academy, it's important to understand, you know, what tournaments they're going to play. Because for kids, you know, training 4 or 5 hours a day can become old really quick. You know, so making sure that they have access to match play at the facility and they have access to tournaments locally, I think is vital, you know, to them really enjoying and developing their game.
Yeah. And so for your program here, the morning program, what does that encompass in terms of time on court, you know, conditioning, strength and conditioning, fitness, and then match play?
Yeah. So we've got a certified fitness trainer on site. He's also, you know, he also teaches tennis. He really enjoys it. He's passionate about it. So he's involved in both programs. Excuse me. And in the mornings, yeah, it's definitely more live ball, and it's definitely more match play related. So, you know, I would say those players in the full-time program are going to play probably between 8 and 10 sets a week, which is really, really important. That's something, you know, in traveling around the country and working with USTA as a faculty coach, we've done several studies, and the most successful academies are doing that. Their top players are playing 6 or more sets a week. That's something, you know, I've seen in Northern Cal, same thing, you know, the top programs there, you know, are playing sets, you know, pretty much every day. You know, if a player is playing full-time 4 hours, there's a portion in there of skill building. Then you go to your live ball session where you can, you know, develop that skill and work on it. But you got to play sets. And, you know, I've been to some other sections where they're struggling. Maybe it's court time. Maybe it's, you know, coaching, maybe it's just money financially related, but they're not playing sets. You know, the sets they're playing are in the tournaments, and then they're behind the eight ball.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's sort of what we see here in Louisville. You know, in Louisville, you know, our calendar is about 6 months out of the year. We're indoor. So indoor court time is at a premium, and there's just not enough of it for that match play. So what we end up doing is the tournaments become our match play. And like you say, that's just not good enough in terms of, you know, keeping up with the kids that are maybe in a Southern climate that can, you know, play a little bit more. So, yeah. So, I mean, I think you're right. You know, I think you have to have a lot of set play, but also a lot of, you know, structure in terms of fed balls and skill building and things, and then putting those skills into practice in the sets with the coaches watching and observing and, you know, giving feedback. So I think that's a really critical element of a successful program.
Yeah. And I think a lot of times, you know, when, you know, and here's some advice for parents is when you're looking for a program, you know, it's important to see the coaches develop progressions, you know, progressing from, you know, simple skills or things that the kids can accomplish, you know, to things that are more complex, things that are, you know, more into live ball. You know, I've been to some academies and they've got the same practice every single day, you know, Monday through Friday, you know, okay, let's hit down the line. Let's hit cross courts, you know, let's hit volleys. Okay. That's 40 minutes of our practice. Okay. Well, were the kids really engaged? I mean, was there, you know, a real plan? There's no progression. So to give you an example, I mean, we have, you know, a volley day once a week in my program or an attacking day. So, you know, we'll spend a couple minutes doing ground strokes, but the rest of their 25 minute warm-up, you know, is spent on high lows, you know, low volleys, overheads. It's spent on, you know, three ball closing drill. It's spent on crossing doubles. So, you know, that's another way, you know, to keep not only keep the kids engaged, you know, but to, you know, make sure that they're progressing, you know, and that's really important. I mean, with kids these days, you know, I mean, you guys know, I mean, you know, the culture has changed in regards to how the kids stay engaged with things that they like, you know, and this is also, it's not just to keep them engaged, right? It's not just, okay, we want them to keep playing tennis, although that's very important. We want them to get better, right? We want to get them better every single week, right? So at the end of the week, man, you know, this kid did really well on his volleys, you know, next week, you know, let's continue with that one attack day.
Yeah. Yeah. So just to go back and clarify, you know, some of your thoughts there, but when you talk about, you know, maybe those first 30, 40 minutes of, you know, going down the middle, going cross courts and et cetera, down the line, is that something that you think should always be part of the practice, but just requires engagement focus, because that sort of is your foundation. That should be your baseline. You know, you should always be able to rely on, and when I need to make some cross courts, I can do that. So that should be part of it, but the engagement should be up. And you do that by also incorporating other learning techniques into the practice after that, in terms of, you know, volleys and things like that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. I mean, and one of my, you know, one of my favorite drills, and, you know, coaches have all different variations, but we're lucky enough to have all our courts lined with 60-foot lines, right, for our younger players. So that's a line that's, you know, essentially between the service line and the baseline. We do a great drill called a 20 ball depth drill. So you're rallying, right? It's cooperative, but it's also competitive. So if I'm rallying cross court, I've got to get 20 balls past that 60 foot line. So the ball has sufficient depth before my guy that I'm hitting with gets into me. And you can vary this for any age or level. I mean, the younger players, the younger high performance players probably only need to get to 10. 20 would take them too long, but you know, my top players and young pros, you know, I say, hey, you know, let's 20 deep. And they should do this in, you know, 3-4 minutes. You know, so absolutely, I agree with you. You know, that's, you know, the baseline. You got to be able to rally. You got to have, you know, shot tolerance, as we saw with Novak and Medvedev. You know, but yeah, you got to make things fun. You got to make them, you know, like we talked about, that's competitive. Yeah. So, you know, if the first 20 minutes of your practice, it's not competitive, you know, you're probably not going to have a lot of engagement.
I like that a lot. That makes a lot of sense. I think you're right. You know, we have to understand what it takes, and then also make that how to get there, make it fun along the way, without sacrificing things that they need for their development. So that makes a lot
absolutely
of sense.
And that's, you know, that's the art of coaching. You know, when you watch great coaches, you know, I was lucky enough to, you know, spend a lot of time with Jose Aguirre, you know, and, you know, we're talking about drills, but one of the main things I learned from Jose was how to connect with the player, right? How to really connect with them, get them to trust you over a short period of time. I was down in Carson at a symposium, and I think he was thrown on court with 3 or 4 players that were pretty good. I wouldn't say that they were top level national players, you know, 13, 14 years old, and they were struggling. You know, there was probably 100 coaches right there, you know, sitting right next to the court, and they were struggling. And, you know, Jose, you know, made a joke or two, brought him in. He actually adjusted the drill. He made it a little bit easier, you know, but still challenging. And they went back out and they killed it. And, you know, Jose just, you know, kind of lightened the mood a little bit, you know, and, you know, yeah, just connected with them. So that's, you know, that's something as parents, as you're looking for your program, is the coach connecting with the players? You know, is he or she moving around, you know, the courts, you know, during a session, and are they connecting, you know, or are they just directing? You know, there's two different ways to run a practice, I think. You know, you have to direct sometimes, right? You got to direct traffic, but you also have to go over and connect with the player, you know, and maybe that's a player that's struggling, right? That's probably a player we need to spend a little more time with.
Yeah. You know, one of the things I noticed is once the kids get the baseline we were talking about, you know, that basic baseline of being able to, you know, rally deep repeatedly and have a shot tolerance, the next beneficial thing is introducing some of those patterns, right? Being able to slice out wide and follow it with a, you know, forehand to the open court or behind the player. When do you start introducing some of that pattern play? And I know it's probably skill-based. You may have 10-year-olds that you introduce it to, and some of them may be 14 before you introduce it. But kind of what's your philosophy on how to get that going with the player?
When they're 5 or 6 years old.
And so but the question is then, if they can't hit a slice serve, how are you going to work a slice out wide with a kid that can't hit a slice?
Okay, you're talking about serving. Oh, I thought you were talking about ground strokes. So we'll start there though. We'll start with the young ones. So we introduced triangles, you know, 2 cross 1 line, 3 cross 1 line. We introduced triangles with 5 and 6 year olds. You know, and that's, you know, that's one where, you know, they're playing with the appropriate ball, and they've got, you know, the right, you know, court size, they can do it. You know, so that's, yeah, patterns are from a young age. You know, I've got a fun game too, you know, where, you know, I stand in the middle of the court, you know, I can put my racket out, but if they get the ball past me, you know, maybe even it's a little bit out, you know, the players get points. So they're starting to learn how to hit to corners, hit away from my opponent. So that starts at a young age. As far as patterns, you know, with serving, yeah, absolutely. You have to have the serve down, you know, but yeah, I mean, if a player, you know, is in a high performance program, you know, if they're, you know, 11, 12 years old, they should be learning serve +1, you know, return +1, you know, you know, it's great to watch Novak and Medvedev, how much they return through the middle, deep middle. And that's a great pattern as well, right? Is they return deep middle and the opponent has no angle. So now, if they get a ball that's somewhat easy on the next shot, they can create an angle. But yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, patterns off the ground at a young age, you know, and then when they transition, you know, even to, I mean, I've got orange ballers, you know, 8, 9 year olds, they're doing serve plus one. So it happens before they get to yellow ball for sure.
When I think the interesting thing, I don't know if you watched the Marty Fish documentary, but the scene where they're at the Western and Southern and Marty's returning and he's going, well, I know he's going to serve to my forehand, but he knows I know he's going to serve to my forehand. And then he gets himself, you know, I always said when I coach football, when you're thinking, you're stinking, right? And he basically got himself so caught up in thought that he wasn't able to do anything at all. And that kind of that anticipation of what's coming and being able to play that anticipation. But what really impressed me in that scene was the way that each player, when they wanted to be able to hit down the tee or wanted to be able to hit out wide, had the ability to do it on demand, right? What age do you normally see in your top level juniors where they begin to really be able to hit, say, from the ad side, right-handed slice down the tee, or a lefty able to hit on the deuce side, a kick out wide? At what point do you start seeing them begin to master that where they can do it at a high probably, or, you know, at a high frequency?
Yeah. Well, first let me just say what an incredible documentary that was. All of the listeners should go watch that. All of the listeners should share that on their social media. Incredible. I'm the same age as Andy, just a bit younger than Marty. I grew up playing with both of them in juniors. And then a little bit on tour and both great guys. So just want to say that. In regards to proficiency, you know, the serve is a tough shot. You know, the serve is a shot that some kids can grasp at a younger age, you know, but a lot of times, you know, executing that shot, you know, in specific spins doesn't happen until 13, 14 years old. You know, and under pressure, maybe it doesn't happen until, you know, 15, 16 years old. So it takes a long time. I mean, that's the shot that, you know, is, there's a lot of movement to it. You know, there's a lot of, variables. So you don't see many players, you know, and I go to nationals, I go to, you know, all the 14 under nationals, you know, to scout with head. And I don't see a lot of the 14 and under players executing spots on the serve that well. So to be honest, I mean, a lot of times it you know, may go to 14, 15 years old before they're really executing under pressure. You know, and but part of that is, you know, those kids are still growing. So they're, you know, understanding their body, understanding how to unload the leg, understanding their, how long their levers are, how long is, you know, my arm, how much do I need to reach up? So yes, you know, serve targets is hard. You know, but if you're making it fun in practice, and like we do team targets, you know, they've got to hit a certain amount of target, you know, so many times, you know, to beat the other team, you know, that can help.
Yeah. And just to echo what you said, that documentary is just outstanding. You know, my son watched it and it motivated him. He's, you know, he's like, Dad, let's go work out in the mornings. Let's go play tennis in the afternoons. It gave him a shot in the arm. Right. So that was a great
documentary. That's great. Yes. Yeah. Everyone go check that out on Netflix.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially the part where Marty was, you know, showing what he needed to do to get into the top 10 and how hard he was working. That was really inspirational, I think, to all the young tennis players out there. But hey, before we wrap up this particular episode, let me ask your thoughts on, you know, you say you've been around the country, you've seen a lot of the things what the sections do. I'm curious if you have any thoughts on what maybe is being done internationally and why it seems as though, you know, maybe on the men's side, at least, the European model, or if there is such thing as a European model and not necessarily an Italian or a Spanish or a French model, what are the Europeans doing so well that maybe the US is not doing?
Well, I don't know if that we have enough time in this episode.
True.
Kidding. Italy in itself is doing an incredible job. They are absolutely crushing it. And I'm not just talking about, you know, our head players, Berrettini, Musetti, and Sinner. Sinner's one of my favorites. But
yep.
So Italy, one of the greatest things they're doing is collaborating. You know, I've had the pleasure of getting to know Craig O'Shaughnessy, an incredible mind in the game of tennis. He is a world-class tennis analyst. You know, he works with top players and their analytics and their patterns and essentially scouting and beating other players. He was with Novak for 2 years. Right now he's with Alexi Papyrin.
Yeah.
But Craig is collaborating with the Italian Tennis Federation and their coaching staff for some time now. And I think their coaches are mandated to come to, you know, certain symposiums. But the symposiums are worthwhile. They're not just, you know, something where you sit in a room and you listen to somebody speak about, you know, their past successes. They're getting on the court, you know, they're working with young players. They're trying new things, you know, things that actually work. But you know, they're collaborating, they're open to new ideas. I think that's something that is really, really important. In regards to the European model, I mean, there's a lot of different ways to do it. I mean, you know, those countries, you know, have large federations, you know, maybe not as big as the USTA, but they still have, you know, some bureaucracy involved. One of the key components why Europe does so well is because they're able to compete, and they're able to compete locally. You know, I played professionally quite a bit in Europe, and there was always access to different clubs, different tournaments, different opportunities to make a little bit of money. You know, obviously the club tennis model has helped European tennis. It helps inspire younger players at the club when they see the teaching pros and traveling pros come in and play on the weekend. It's a big event, right?
Yeah. So just interrupt really quick. What is the club tennis model in Europe, and why don't we have it here in the U.S.?
Oh, well, yeah, good question. I'm just saying it's a great question. The club tennis model is essentially, you know, developing a team, you know, that has ties to your club, or maybe doesn't have ties, but you're going to pay somebody to come in. You know, they play once or twice in the weekend, you know, for a certain number of weeks. There's a lot of money involved, and you want to be the best club. You know, there's a lot of pride involved with that. You know, a lot of clubs also offer the ability to get housed, you know, let's say for the summer, and you're able to go and travel wherever you want, you know, from Monday to Friday, Monday to Saturday, but you've got to be on site Sunday ready for a match. So it's not a large time commitment. If you're good enough, that club will pay for you to travel to other events, you know, so you stay affiliated with the club.
Right. So why don't we have it in America? Right. Because that sounds
well,
awesome.
We're too spread out. Right. The country's too big. You know, obviously,
Europe's,
you know,
so close, and they can get on a train and go from France to Spain in an afternoon. Right.
But I mean, yeah, can we do like a Northeast?
Germany has, you know, one of the best systems. You know, France is great as well. But, you know, yeah, Germany, you've got, you know, maybe six clubs within, you know, 30, 40 miles of each other. You know, that all have teams with, you know, top ATP players, mid-level ATP players, maybe, you know, one coach from their club.
Yeah. You know, so it's no different than why Southern Cal has good junior tennis, because within an hour, there's a large population with a lot of coaches. And so it just naturally grows, just like Atlanta or any of these other cities that are kind of
right.
Tennis
hubs. And obviously weather and court space, you know, has a lot to do with it. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of competition. There's, you know, ability to grow. There's great coaches, you know, and there's a great history.
I hear McEnroe say this a lot. He says, we don't have enough juniors who are hungry enough in America playing tennis. And my opinion of why that is it's just too expensive, right? So what are some ways you've seen where your academy or other academies have found ways? Because you think about back in Volatieri's day, right? I mean, it made him go bankrupt. He'll tell you that, right? He gave too many scholarships. He gave too many scholarships, so he went bankrupt. But it also was a scenario that allowed people of normal means, regular means, to still get their child in a competitive environment. So how do you see that impacting, and how are some of the ways maybe you at your academy are addressing that?
Well, I think any successful business should have a nonprofit, you know, as a way to do that, to help, you know, do outreach, do grassroots, you know, so our you know, academy, or sorry, our club, you know, part of our mission is, our club is actually built with a sizable donation from a father that lost two daughters in a car crash, two junior tennis players. Amanda and Stacy Darling. So Fred Darling had put a, put a large grant together, large donation together, and the city matched it. So in our mission statement, you know, in our contract, we have to run a certain number of junior events. We have to, you know, offer a certain number of junior programs. But going back to your question, every successful tennis program, tennis club should have a nonprofit, as do we. And every tennis club, tennis program should be doing some type of school and grassroots outreach. You know, before COVID, I think we reached out to about 1,200 kids in our local school system that had access to, you know, we would go to their school, we do, you know, fun day with them, you know, we do tennis programming, and then we'd offer discounts. You know, if they wanted to come out, you know, their first couple of months, they got a discount. You know, if a player committed, you know, then we'd go through a vetting process with our nonprofit. You know, so it could work. I mean, I know picking the brain of you know, Ray Benton out of JTCC, one of the top, you know, developmental programs in the U.S. over the last two decades. They have an incredibly vast network of people that donate and a structure of their nonprofit. So, and grassroots outreach, you know, you've got to have it.
Right. And I think that you mentioned JTCC. I think they probably are recognized, maybe nationally, as probably the academy that's done it the best. Would you agree?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I mean, there's probably some other ones that do it really well, but I mean, I've had experience working with them, you know, seeing their models, and obviously, you know, we know how good the players are coming out of there. So yeah, I mean, they're doing it really, really well.
Well, Brian, this has been a great conversation. I hope the listeners have enjoyed listening to kind of part two. Obviously, we want to have two more to follow just to kind of pick your brain and some of those other topics that Scott was bringing up. I know that Scott's real passionate about what the other countries like Canada and Italy are doing. And so I hope in our next episode, we can really dive deep into that discussion.
Well, that's interesting because the Canadian model is pretty incredible. And I've done a fair amount of research on their long-term athlete development program. It's like 120 page document. But it's fun to see. I mean, it's inspiring and who knows? I mean, maybe our friends to the north, maybe they're putting some pressure on us down here. You know, and that forced to change a few things. But always a pleasure to talk with you guys. I appreciate what you do.
Yeah, I know that you got to get out for the kickoff of the Seahawks game, so we'll let you go. But we look forward to the next one.
Thanks, guys. Take care.